hour number two on this Monday. Welcome in. Buck Rising here with you till 1 o'clock. Lucas Panzeca making all things go behind the glass. Happy to have you guys as a part of the proceedings. A lot of festivities happening today across the Nashville airwaves after the Tennessee Titans able to get that 27, not able, but definitively getting that 27-3 victory over the Kansas City Chiefs yesterday at Nissan Stadium. You guys want to get involved? We'll get to your phone calls here in just a second. 615-737-1045. 615-737-1045 is the number. But and typically I don't like to reset a conversation that we just had because you may not have been listening, and so maybe it doesn't mean anything to you what we talked about last segment. But I have to read a tweet that made me laugh. Because we have a poll question out. We were talking about Titans fans and their you know, conflicted relationship with national media and why do they insist on being this kind of thirsty and blah, 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 whatever. So somebody responds to the poll at Buck Rising on Twitter. His Twitter handle is Ace Spade at Uptown Spade. He says, because he's going back at me, he says, where would you be without media attention? Does he not know that we are the media attention? Does he think that people were paying attention to us and that's what caused us to become media members?
I think it's a swing and a miss here from our buddy.
I don't understand what he's saying. Do you think people were paying attention to me when I was completely, you know, irrelevant, you know, just toiling away, mining audio from play-by-play calls in Alabama or Winnipeg from midnight to 6 a.m.? En route to becoming, you know, whatever the hell this is right now. Me, where would I be without media attention?
You'd be nothing.
We had to create the media attention.
Nothing.
What kind of stupid ass comment is that? Do people not? I mean, listen, I'm as guilty of this as anybody because the misspellings of my tweets have become a legitimate problem. So much so that I think I'm just no longer going to bother to spell check my tweets and make the misspellings intentional. But, like, I swear to God, people just don't read what they type before they press send. This is a Herm Edwards-type situation. Deborah, Puka is the only person who remembers the name of the first radio show that I had, Tackling Music City. My God, what a throwback. And that's because we couldn't use anything that had the word Titans, Tighten Up, or Two-Tone Blue in it. It was a terrible, terrible time. But, you know, that's what gave birth to all this, so we're very happy about it. Whatever. 615-737-1045. Let's talk about something that does deserve attention from national media or otherwise. Let's talk about this Titans offense that absolutely put it on the Kansas City Chiefs defense yesterday. Now, we talked about how not favorable a matchup this was for Kansas City going in, but I never thought it would look the way that it did for 60 minutes of football at Nissan yesterday. You're talking about a Titans team that coming into the game had scored 20 points in the first quarter all year long through six games. 20 points is all that they had been able to muster. Their inability to start fast is what allows teams like the Colts or the Jets to hang around longer than they absolutely should be able to. And yesterday, not only did they score on their first possession, they scored a touchdown on their first possession after Kansas City won the toss and deferred. So you immediately did the thing that you had to do to start that game. Score first, get the lead, and hold it. They came right back down the field on their first possession, and not only was the play calling exceptional, not only did they get their star players involved because I had to adjust my glasses basically to make sure that I actually saw that they threw a first down pass on the first play of the game instead of handing it off to Derek. I was in shock. Todd Downing in his bag. Play action, first down. Oh my God. So he hits a play action pass to A.J. Brown. A.J. Brown involved early and often. He was targeted nine times. He caught eight passes, including that 46-yarder that they tried to rule an incompletion and then ultimately overturned because he did complete the process of a catch. You're rattling down the field. You're going play action pass to A.J., hand off to Derek, Julio Jones, you're already on the opponent's side of the field. So you're getting your stars involved. Your offensive game plan is creative. And your efficiency, your execution of the game plan that was designed was tops. They killed it in every phase on offense yesterday in the first half. Now, Mike Vrabel came into the press conference kind of pissed off last night, as he typically does after they win, which is always so funny to me. But I'm sure he felt that they could have capitalized on more opportunities in the second half because, of course, they didn't score in the second half. But at that point, the game was in hand. Now, maybe the game is never in hand against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, but that is not a game where I looked at the Kansas City Chiefs and said, yeah, they're any kind of a threat today. Just had nothing on either side of the ball. It was weird, really weird to watch. I've seen him play live. That would have been my third time, right? Because Titans, week 10, here in Nashville in 2019, went to Kansas City for the AFC title game, saw him play then, and now this being the third time, it looked completely different than every other time in, you know, a million games on television because the Chiefs are always on. This is the first time that he looked this disjointed, and they, as a team, looked that kind of, not unprepared is probably an unfair word, but they just didn't look like they had answers for anything across the board. So the Titans offense, they get the playmakers involved. Todd Downing gets in his bag. They got Derrick Henry in what Mike Keith calls the King Cat, which is Derrick Henry Wildcat formation. Derrick Henry not only, Derrick Henry says, bleep you and your MVP is only a quarterback award. I'm going to throw a touchdown pass and then you tell me that I don't deserve the MVP. And he did it. Hit Michael Pruitt from 5 yards out. And honestly, he had two guys wide the hell open to his left. Not like I'm asking Derrick Henry to go through his passing progressions, but he had them. They were there. So it would have been a touchdown either way. It was such an exceptional offensive performance to witness because it wasn't just that they scored first. They went right back down the field again. They got A.J. Brown involved. He was a big part of the passing game. The play-action passing game ate just because of the threat of Derrick Henry, who had probably one of his statistically least impressive performances of the year if you were just to box score scout him. But that's stupid if you're somebody who's doing that. It completely ignores the impact that he has by just simply being out on the field. And going back to Monday Night Football, where Derrick Henry's 76-yard touchdown run comes out of a three-wide receiver set, what they call 11 personnel, right? It's the threat of Julio and AJ on the outside, spreads out the defense, wide open running lanes for Derrick Henry to gash you for 76 yards. It's the threat of them being out there, simply available, that allows you to create more of these explosive plays, more of these opportunities, and the offense did that in stride yesterday. I think that, and Ryan Tannehill talked about this. I asked Ryan Tannehill about this, I asked Derrick Henry about this, what it meant for them to score on their first possession and to kind of get that momentum in a way that they have struggled to do consistently throughout the course of this season. This is what Derrick Henry had to say.
Have a strong drive and finish in the end zone. I was glad that we definitely did that. I felt like they got the momentum going, and we were able to, put drives together, finish in the end zone. Guys making plays, guys finishing blocks, and getting downfield. So yeah, definitely happy we were able to get in the end zone early.
It made all the difference in the world. Made his life a hell of a lot easier, and it made the defense's life easier too. You'll hear from Ryan Tannehill on what that defense allowed them to do as an offense because of the way that they were playing. Coming up next, we'll also have Austin Berlage of Power T Tape. But before we do that, I think somebody has an apology to make. At least I hope that he's prepared to make an apology, because Ryan Tannehill deserves an apology from our next caller, Darrington.
Okay, yeah, put pressure on me then. Why don't you? Okay. I would like to give flowers to the first half to Ryan Baker Mayfield Tannehill, because that's what we turned into in the second half.
You're the worst.
But, yeah, I give him his flowers. He was great. I want to give flowers to Jim Schwartz, because I know he has something to do with this defense. Harold Landry was effective on pass rushing 87% of the time that he was on the field. He was not covering anybody. I loved it. I loved it. Also, I don't know which Titan fan blocked me on Twitter, got my account hijacked. So what?
Oh, you get shut down on Twitter? Wait. You got shut down on Twitter?
Yes, I've been shut down on Twitter.
You know why? Because you said Ryan Tannehill is Baker Mayfield. Get him the hell out of here. Shut down on Twitter. Shut down on the phone lines. Darrington, got to do better, my guy. We'll come back. We'll let you hear from the aforementioned Ryan Baker Mayfield Tannehill, as Darrington so eloquently put it, and we will do some Power T tape analysis with our buddy Austin Burlage as well, because the Vols had a surprising, it ended up being an unsurprising result, but the way that they went about it was pretty impressive to watch. Moral victories on the other side. I'm Buck Rising. It's 104.5 The Zone. Nothing gets the people going like Metallica. I was rocking this on the way to the stadium yesterday. I like to put out a little pregame music, get the ambiance going on Sundays or game days, whatever. Metallica, vastly underrated. Oh, you just killed it on me. Here I'm enjoying myself. No, I don't know what's in there. I don't know what the lyrics are in there. Get out of there.
But underrated by who?
By me.
Our age, our generation.
Oh, yeah. People under the age of 30.
Mickey Ryan's listening to this thing. Underrated. What are you talking about?
They're the greatest metal band of all time. Underrated. And I'm just like, oh, these guys are pretty good. I just remember them from like a sad, you know, like a sad Saturday Night Live performance where they're on a stage. They're not in front of a people or headbanging and hair waving and all these things.
But they still play stadiums.
Metallica?
Oh, yeah.
All right, so put it on the poll. Am I criminally underrating Metallica as the greatest metal band of a generation? At Buck Rising is where you can vote on the polls. Speaking of criminally underrated, as I do my hacky sports talk radio tease, Ryan Baker Mayfield Tannehill, as Darrington called him earlier in the show. You know what? Ryan Tannehill has been sacked once in the last two games against the Buffalo Bills, a great defense, and the Kansas City Chiefs, an admittedly stinky defense. But still, for a quarterback who had been to that point sacked 20 times, for him to come out of two games that clean, that's a very exciting development for you to see, especially that when you consider the starting left tackle for the Tennessee Titans for a vast majority of the snaps yesterday was a dude that they signed on Saturday. Has anybody heard of Bobby Hart prior to him going into the lineup yesterday? He was on our flip card, thank God, in the press box because I was like, who the hell is 68? Who is that guy? I had no idea. And then I was waiting for the inevitable, you know, slip up by the third string left tackle so I could put out I can't do a Hank Hill impression, but a damn it, Bobby, gif or meme on social media just because, you know, I'm shameless with my constant pursuit of likes. But it was something for the Titans that you feel pretty good about right now. Without Taylor Lewan yesterday, not available due to a concussion or being still in the concussion protocol. I saw him strolling the sidelines yesterday throughout the course of the game, but not available to play. Then you have Kendall Lamb, the backup, going down with an ankle injury after he had played pretty well. And the only sack of Ryan Tannehill was credited to not an offensive lineman, although there were some pressures allowed. The only sack was credited to Jeremy McNichols. So it came in an obvious passing down situation when Jeremy McNichols was on the field. Ryan Tannehill was as effective as I've ever seen him in the first half of that game, and it's largely because of the impact of the Chiefs having to account for Derrick Henry.
They're mixing it up. You know, they're giving us safeties down low. They would roll one back. They're going back to Tampa. You know, they're really rolling the coverages on us and giving us a bunch of different looks. But we were able to take advantage of some middle safety a few times there. Got one-on-one matchups when that happens, and our guys made plays. So if teams are going to, you know, try to take away Derek by stacking the box, then we have to be able to win on the outside.
How much, Brian, do you feel like his offense is kind of really starting to hit a stride, and how much does back-to-back games like this do for the team's confidence?
We're heading in the right direction. You know, we've done some good things. I felt like we built on what we started in the second quarter last week and were able to get going and finish that game, win the game. against a good opponent and build on that today, coming out, getting a fast start and scoring a lot of points early. So hopefully we can just keep the course, keep working and keep being better.
That is Ryan Tannehill talking about the strides that the offense has found itself in. Now, I want you to look at this one stat, and this was from Thomas Gower yesterday on Twitter. He went through and looked up the next-gen stats on Ryan Tannehill. Ryan Tannehill averaged 2.17 seconds as far as time to throw is concerned. Not only is 2.17 seconds average time to throw the lowest of any quarterback this week heading into Monday Night Football, 2.17 seconds time to throw average is the lowest time to throw of a quarterback this season. You wanted Ryan Tannehill to quit holding the ball? Ryan Tannehill said, all right, bleep you. I'm going to get rid of it literally as soon as the ball hits my hands. And it led to great success for the Titans as a result. Didn't hurt that they had A.J. Brown and Julio Jones in the lineup for a bulk of that game as well. But let's pivot and let's talk about what happened to Tennessee and Tuscaloosa on Saturday night. Because the start of that game, in fact, basically almost halfway through the third quarter, I thought about texting Lucas, oh my God, am I going to have to lead with the Vols on Monday morning? And then the second half went the way that it did, and things spiraled very quickly. And so now we have Austin Berlage of Power T Tape to tell us, what the hell, Austin?
Yeah, what the hell? I'm still mad. Still mad about 4th-and-1, Buck. I've tried to get over it.
That's so bad.
You know? I've tried all the techniques, and still mad about it. Still mad about it.
How? Okay, so, I mean, I understand that he was asked about this, Josh Heupel was, after the game, and that the explanation was what it was, right? He wasn't going to give you anything of legitimate substance in that moment. But after the 4th-and-1 delay of game, the fact that that game in the last 19 minutes goes 28-7 Alabama on Tennessee's neck after it was a one-touchdown difference throughout the majority of the game. How the hell do you let that go? How can you?
It's inexplicable to me, especially because, you know, we go back to last week against Ole Miss, right? We talked about it on the show last Monday about how Tennessee had, I think, 3, if I recall, punts from Ole Miss territory. And, you know, you kind of wondered, like, well, against Lane Kiffin, like, you want to get in a back and forth like that? When are we going to be aggressive? And then, yeah, you're trailing by a score on the road between the 40s. And I understand, and we can talk about it, that Tennessee could not run the ball, like, whatsoever. I get it. But the immediate play preceding it on, like, 3rd-and-5 was a designed QB run to Hooker, who picked up like four or five on like 3rd-and-5 or 6. So, you know, he was probably, I mean, when they did run him, he ran fine. And I get that you are worried about Alabama's front and what, but if you can't pick up a yard or you're worried about picking up a yard. And here's the other thing. Why not use a timeout in that situation? I mean, we didn't use any timeouts again going in the first half. And then we're in the second half. Like, just call a timeout. Nobody's making you take a delay of game and punt it, right? And I understand that pace is part of what we do, and, you know, maybe you don't want Alabama to sub, maybe all that. But, like, it's a critical moment in the game, and maybe if you don't get it, like, what's the worst that can happen, right? You don't get it, and then
and it
Alabama
snowballs
the
anyway.
Right. It's, they get the ball 38 yards ahead of where they eventually got it, and the score ends up the same way. So I really don't know what you have to lose in that situation, and it baffles me. We're getting really negative, and we shouldn't, because we did better than we thought we would. I think Tennessee has exceeded expectations to this point in the year, but I just don't understand that decision.
Well, and so, because you're right, because I was talking to my girlfriend about this, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to watch the Tennessee game. Maybe it'll be at a blowout by halftime, and then we can find something else to do so I don't spend my entire life watching sports and you hate me because of it. And I turn the game on, and I'm like, oh, they're going to go shot for shot with Alabama. And they did consistently up until that point where it seemed things started to spiral. And they struggled mightily on 3rd downs, 2 of 12 against Alabama. the inability to run the football was clear and obvious to everybody. How much of a limited Hendon Hooker and what was happening with Tyon Evans, because I was frankly surprised to see him out there, how much did that hinder what they wanted to do offensively?
Yeah, I do think, especially in the run game, I think missing Cade Mays there too was a big deal at right tackle.
Sure.
As well. But yeah, Hooker, I think, was better than I expected, at least he would be after what the injury looked like. I know they said during the week he was able to be mobile and he came out and looked good in pregame and ran well, but I don't think there were as many designed runs for him as there have been in past weeks, and that was probably by design. I think the big thing is Alabama's players were a little bit better. I think we can agree on that, and what they were able to do in terms of adding guys to the box. I mean, when they were playing their base defense, they would walk up the safety and get, you know, seven guys on basically six blockers. So Tennessee would have like the five-man line and a tight end, and Alabama would have their four defensive linemen, two linebackers, and then they'd drop in a safety a lot of the time or a nickel. So they were able to get numbers that way. Plus, when they were in a particular front, their linebackers were able to trigger really fast. So I think their players were a little bit better on average. And then obviously the injuries hampered us a little bit. And that is a big chunk of why, you know, Tennessee couldn't run it. But they did a great job of taking advantage of matchups and taking advantage of alignments. And that's where, you know, Tennessee. So I went back as I watched, and Tennessee had three touchdown passes. All three were basically busted plays. And for a while, I started thinking about that and going, oh, you know, maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe that isn't a good sign. But I think, you know, that's kind of where Tennessee is right now. We don't have the athletes to go shot for shot with Alabama, but our pace can give you problems, and the spacing of the receivers can give you problems. And next thing you know, we're able to get in a good leverage position, like on the Velus Jones touchdown or the Javonte Payton touchdown, and get back on the board really quick.
Cedric Tillman for Heisman, as far as I'm concerned. Austin Burlage of Power T Tape is here with us on 104.5 The Zone. At Austin _Burlage is where you can follow him for his Vols analysis.
Yeah, to build off that, Austin, because I think a lot of people on social media were frustrated with Greg McElroy, who was on the analysis on SEC or on ESPN, talking about Alabama's misalignment and that being the cause of Tennessee's big plays. But it kind of got me thinking, is that not kind of the point of this tempo? When you look at like triple option teams like Army, how good of a job they do in reducing talent deficiencies, and you often see them playing close games against teams that on paper are much better than them. I wonder if, even though this system is basically the polar opposite of a triple option, it kind of effectively does the same thing when you catch a defense on its heels, unable to make subs, and you're able to get them misaligned, and you're able to make up for that talent deficiency a little bit, and that's what leads to some of the big plays. Do you kind of read that the same way?
Yeah, I Lucas, I am in total agreement with you. They go about it different ways, but it ends up being a similar result. And I think, you know, too, so obviously Tennessee's on the road, so when they get into critical situations like second and third down, then the crowd gets really loud, and then the defense has a touch. So it's hard enough to communicate already, and now the crowd's so loud that you can't hear. So you have to be watching for signals from, you know, the other players on the field, from the sideline, and being mindful for Tennessee to how they're going to line up, and then any motions like it and snapping the ball every 8 to 10 seconds. So it can be really tricky. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I think part of me was a little at first I thought, you know, I wish we could have just lined up and beat them. But I think that's, you, and some people might call it a gimmick or what have you, but I think that's just part of what makes this offense so difficult is, you know, can you get all lined up and communicate and everything? And, you know, I think with the McElroy thing, right, if a different announcer says the same thing, it probably doesn't
yeah,
carry the same weight, right?
Yeah.
But when the former Alabama quarterback, I think he won a title there, when he says it, right, it's a little bit different.
I mean, Bama fans were on Twitter complaining he was too unbiased.
It was so funny to watch people react to just Greg McElroy's commentary. Like, that was as much fun in the second half as anything any team was doing on the field. Austin Burlage here with us on 104.5 The Zone. Is that the most undisciplined Nick Saban team you've seen?
Well, probably not ever. I mean, that 2007 squad that he had wasn't really good. But I think you know, I think Alabama, I'm not going to say they're not the Alabama that we've seen because they're still obviously really, really good. But I think that they showed some weaknesses. Like, they can be had a little bit in the secondary. You know, if you have the guy, like Tillman, we beat Josh Jobe one-on-one because Josh Jobe, I tweeted out the picture late last night. I mean, he wasn't even looking at the play because he was actually turned, his back was to Tillman at the start of the play, which was kind of funny to me. But yeah, I think their safety play, they're really good defending the run. I think Tennessee took advantage of them in the passing game. And then what I would also say too is they're led by a freshman quarterback who I know is really good, but he's not, he's still a freshman. And then obviously their receiving core is still decent, but nothing like the stable of pro guys that they were cranking out over the last 3 or 4 years. So yeah, they're still obviously really good, but they're not necessarily as good as you would think in terms of what we've seen over the last couple of days. But yeah, still some discipline issues. Obviously the block punt was hilarious, but as I say that, you know, Tennessee was only had the block punt and a fumble, and they only managed to get 3 points and went three and out both times.
So now heading into the bye week, Austin, and with Kentucky ahead, I guess health is at the utmost importance at this point, but how would you kind of assess this season thus far as the Josh Heupel experience? Because he had me all in up until the 4th-and-1, and I think there was some question. It was by far and away not his best play calling game, particularly on third down, but I think there are so many redeeming qualities about what he is and what his staff is doing at this point. I wonder what your assessment is now at the close to midway point of the season.
Yeah, so when Tennessee hired Heupel, and I knew a little bit about him with UCF, and one of the things that one of my impressions from watching them was just, you know, when they have more talent, they're going to put you in really difficult spots and they're going to put up a lot of points. But what does it look like when you play teams with as much or more talent than you? Can you keep scoring and pull away? And what does it look like when you're running at that pace on your defense? And so when I look at the schedule, you know, unfortunately, Tennessee hasn't beaten anybody good. I mean, and we've played some good teams in Pitt and Alabama, but like Florida, they're 4-6 in their last 10, and we didn't score in the second half against them. And I just wonder, you know, so I think what I would say, because I want to be positive, because I think from what he's done for the culture and in terms of just overall performance is better. And so I would say that they are about as expected, maybe like if I was going to grade it like a B, I think maybe slightly above average that way. But at the same time, like, you know, and I get that it's year one and I understand the roster situation and all that stuff, but you have to make decisions that lead to beating good teams at some point. And Kentucky is a good team this year, and that's going to be a really good test because I think Georgia's going to be really, really tough. And I think the last two games are South Alabama and Vanderbilt, but those should be pretty easy wins. So if you can knock off Kentucky, I think that gets us to 7-5. And I think 7 going to a bowl, like that's probably at or above anybody's expectations going into this year.
There's not a game that I'm going to more actively root for Tennessee in, because if they can't beat Kentucky, Kentucky damn near may go 11-1, and I can't have that. I have too many Kentucky fans in my life to tolerate that.
Yeah, that just can't happen. I don't even want to entertain that. It's a bye week. We have time. I don't even want to go down that road.
All right, very good. Austin Berlage, Power T-Tape, at Austin _Berlage is where you can follow him. Well worth your time to understand on a deeper level what's happening with the Tennessee Volunteers football team. Thank you, buddy.
Boys, I appreciate you. Buck, just a word of advice. I would not let your girlfriend watch Vols football with you for too long. I think if you want to keep that relationship going, you might want to avoid doing that too much.
Well, she came over to the house in a Bussin' with the Boys crew neck the other day, so we're already on rocky terms.
Well, he's not a Vols fan, though, Austin, so it doesn't emotionally damage him as much as it would maybe somebody else watching with their significant other.
That's a good point. I'm just looking out. I care about you, Lucas. I care about Buck. You guys are my friends. I just I would hate to see something happen because of the Vols. Like, I'm already in too deep. I don't want you guys to go down there.
This is speaking from somebody who has been a toxic relationship for a very, very long time.
With the football team.
Thank you, Austin. That's a good clarification by Lucas there. He probably just saved my ass. See you, buddy. Oh, goodness. All right. There's a lot to take away from that Alabama-Tennessee game. And I think a lot more positives than people were expecting. Certainly a lot more positives than I was expecting. So we'll talk about that coming up next and what the Vols, where it kind of feels like they're at now heading into their bye week and sitting in a place where they have the ability to not just exceed their projected win total at the start of the season against Kentucky, but find themselves with legitimate building blocks heading into the future and for recruits to kind of gravitate towards. We'll do that coming up next. Your phone calls as well, 615-737-1045 is how you get involved. I'm Buck Rising. It's 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back. Buck Rising here with you till 1 o'clock. Titans head coach Mike Vrabel is going to meet with the media about 12 minutes from now, so we'll carry that live for you. See if we can get some updates on what's happening at St. Thomas Sports Park after a massive victory over the Kansas City Chiefs yesterday. But in the meantime, let's stick with the Vols for a little bit because it's been an interesting progression to watch. Certainly now that we've gotten to the bye week for Tennessee, you can be a little more reflective about what their season has been. And there's a lot of different angles to look at the University of Tennessee with. And really, the SEC as a whole is a pretty interesting place right now where you're looking at Georgia sitting atop everybody in the SEC. You're looking at Kentucky, is Kentucky the most surprising? Brain Gall of 440 Sports has been telling me that Kentucky's been good this season since, like, May. He has been adamant about this position. He was the only one, though, I really feel was banging the table for Kentucky like that.
I'll raise my hand. I wasn't banging the table for him, but I thought they could be the second best team in the East this season. I thought they had that argument.
By what logic?
By arguably the best offensive line in the league, one of my favorite running backs in the league, and Chris Rodriguez Jr., a really good hire in Liam Cohen from the Rams to run that offense. And if Will Levis, the Penn State transfer, we knew the defense was going to be good. And if Will Levis could help them push the ball downfield at all, which is something that they've struggled to do the entire Mark Stoops era, and have still won games despite that, then yeah, I thought Kentucky had a real shot. Strength of schedule, not the toughest in the league. I really like this Kentucky team. I'm not surprised that they're on the track to win double-digit games.
All right, but narrow that down for me. Fine-tune that a little bit for me, because what does have a shot mean? A shot at what? Because right now they're second in the East.
Yeah, a shot at a 10-win season. That is among the best you'll ever get from Kentucky football. Their best season in program history was in 2018 when they won 10 games and beat Penn State in a bowl game.
Tomahawk Chop 22 is messaging us on Zone TV, and as is William Titan, who's a Kentucky Tackle Cats fan and has been stumping for the Tackle Cats for many, many weeks at this point, many, many months. But Tomahawk writes in, and you can interact with us on Facebook Live, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch on Zone TV, which basically allows you to hang out in the studio with us. Kentucky isn't surprising. They have a really weak schedule. They get the worst two teams in the West, and the East is garbage this season. They barely got by Chattanooga. But you can only play who's on your schedule, right? I think when I say surprising, I'm legitimately surprised that they're the second-best team in the East. I think Florida's collapse has been shocking to me. I think that that's probably the most surprising thing in the sport right now. Do you know, Florida has a worse conference record than Tennessee. Tennessee's 2-2 on the season in the SEC. 2-3 mm-hmm. at this point is Florida, and they have the same overall record.
With Georgia up next.
I know Dan Mullen is facing some stuff there, and he's got boosters on his neck about which quarterback he wants to play, and then when you're in that position, ask Gus Malzahn. It never gets better. It only spirals further on you, and it's not like Florida doesn't have the Florida boosters don't have the wherewithal to keep cranking this dude up. But I've been, I guess, between Kentucky And Ole Miss being second in the West, LSU, I think we were all expecting this to kind of flatline after the way that things went last season. A&M, you know, the injuries have derailed them in a way that's clear and obvious to everybody. Auburn was the wild card, and since Arkansas got off to the darling of the conference, now they sit at the very bottom of the SEC West, which, you know, Sam Pittman and just out here whomping them, it looks a lot worse when you're whomping them at 1-3. Whomping doesn't hit quite the same. 615-737-1045. Who's the most surprising team in the SEC to you now that we've approached at least the bye week for Tennessee? I think that it's okay to be reflective at this point. I remember asking Mike Vrabel reflective questions about his Titans tenure and him being like, yeah, you know, I'm not worried about that right now. We're trying to win football games. Idiot. No, he didn't say that. Do you know what I mean? 615-737-1045. Who's the most surprising team in the SEC to you? I don't think you're going to do much better than Ole Miss and Kentucky. Or if you want to go surprisingly bad, I think Florida would be the correct answer.
And Ole Miss had the preseason Heisman favorite in Matt Corral, and he's leading that race now.
Yeah, but Heisman candidate quarterbacks don't necessarily translate to like outright wins in college football.
But I think everybody anticipated a step forward. You know, it just depends on what context you had in your mind coming into the season of what you expected personally from Kentucky. The tools were always there. Kentucky's just never the flashiest program to look at.
Sure. And then there's Vanderbilt, whose opposing coach is giving post-game press conferences about candy corn as opposed to the game.
You never want to be that team.
Because it was so irrelevant. All right. Mike Vrabel meets with the media at St. Thomas Sports Park. We carry it live for you. Coming up next.